Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, everyone. This is Xander. We have a great guest for you today. Unfortunately, we ran into some technical difficulties in the course of recording the show. So this is going to be part one of two. Jake has been kind enough to offer to loop back with us at a later date. And we'll finish up our discussion there and get it back out to you shortly. Thanks.
Welcome back, everyone, to another great episode of Reconsider, part of the Agora Podcast Network, where we don't do the thinking for you. And today we've got a particularly exciting episode. I know I always say that, but I'm always so excited about them because we've got something new and cool that we've not done before. And actually, this one is one we've done before, kinda. So let me just get to it. We've brought back our great economist, in his own words, Nobel Prize losing economist, Jake Meyer, who was an economist and lecturer at Cal State Long Beach and is now moving on to bigger, better things. It's secret for now, but if you go to his LinkedIn in a few weeks or months, I'm sure it'll be updated. We've got the inside scoop. Too bad for you. You'll get to find out later. But needed to get back in touch with Jake pretty quickly because a lot of stuff has changed in fundamental ways about a lot of important policy, particularly in the United States over the past year. And with all sort of the scandal driven political atmosphere and media, a lot of it gets, you know, buried. And arguably the major policy changes that we're seeing in the US and other parts of the world have far more impact on your life than all of these scandals. So it's stuff that we want you to know about, be able to know about and think about. And last time we had Jake on the show, it was so much fun and so informative that we just had to do it again. And one of the things we love in particular about Jake is that, you know, he's been an academic for a long time and he shares sort of our own passion, which is saying, look, a lot of what's going on in politics, a lot of the important stuff gets discussed in DC, inside the Beltway, and in academic circles in very technically wonky ways, but not in a way that's accessible to most people. It doesn't, you know, you could be educated, you could be smart, but unless you're sort of in these circles, you don't have access to it. And gosh, I forget who said it, Madison or Hamilton or someone, you know, believe that an educated populace is like the bedrock of a great democracy. So that's part of what we do. Jake shares that philosophy with us big time. So it's so great that he agreed to join us once again. So everyone, we are going to be talking about some of those major policy changes, and I would like to heartily welcome back Jake Meyer to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on. It's great to be back.
So we've got this big list of questions for Jake, and I want to dive into one that I've been scratching my head about for a while. And Jake, I don't know if you've got a good eye on this, but something we've talked about recently in our episode about Turkey is that the real is plummeting. You know, at some point we talked in Russia about how the, what was it?
Lira, Turkish lira.
The lira's dropping, the Russian ruble's dropping. And then there's a number of crises going on in other emerging market countries that our listeners probably haven't heard about. Indonesia, Argentina, India, Pakistan. I've only been around for 31 years, but this seems like it's all sort of happening at once. And is there any sort of common thread into what's going on here?
Oh, certainly. Yes. So So a big part of what's happening right now is a great illustration of these global business cycles and these sort of global financial cycles. So looking at it in a very simple sense, the big reason that all these countries are having these sorts of crises at the moment is because the U.S. has finally started to raise interest rates. Now, generally speaking, whenever a core country, especially a country that's at the very core of the financial system, like the U.S., starts raising interest rates, what that does is it makes investing in the U.S. relatively attractive, which means people that were previously making, let's say, 12% in Turkey, seeing that the U.S. interest rate goes from, let's say, 1% to 2%, they start bringing their money back from Turkey to the U.S. Now, when they're bringing their money back from Turkey to the U.S., what's happening is they're having to sell the currency in the country that they're bringing the money from, and they're using it to buy the currency of the country that they are bringing the money to. So what's happening here is as the U.S. is raising interest rates, all of this money that was previously flooding into emerging markets, because the U.S. had essentially an interest rate of zero, along with most of the other countries in the core of the global financial system, like in the Eurozone, you know, UK, they had these very low interest rates. As the interest rates in these core countries are rising up, all that money that was previously flooding into emerging markets is now coming back to these core countries. So everyone who previously invested in these emerging markets is selling the currency of these emerging markets to bring it back to the core countries, which is putting substantial downward pressure on those currencies. And then, of course, you can, you know, have this sort of situation start, and then it can snowball into these sort of speculative attacks and international bank run type events where people see the currency weakening a little. They see what else is happening in the world. They see that that's putting, you know, other parts of their economy and banking system under stress. And then they immediately start engaging in speculative attacks where they sell off the currency all at once in order to try to essentially bet that the currency is going to fall more. And then that snowballs into these massive depreciations and massive devaluations that we're seeing in places like Turkey and Argentina. And of course, like India, Pakistan, Indonesia, it's happening in a broad swath of emerging markets at the moment.
So the first question I want to ask you about this sort of emerging currency crisis or pre-crisis, whatever you want to call it, is if the central if the common cause that kind of ties all of these countries depreciating currencies together is the U.S., the core entity sort of at the center of the global financial system, beginning to raise interest rates and increasing demand for foreign capital flows from the U.S. and it flows out of all of these other countries, then why don't we see something similar, depreciating currency among emerging markets, at the end of every business cycle when the U.S. gets around to raising interest rates?
So there's two aspects of this. One is that to a lesser extent, we kind of do. It's just that in this one specifically, what's been happening is interest rates in the U.S. and other core countries have been so low for so long that what happened is you had these very long running inflows. And then as the money comes into these countries, it makes their currency essentially stronger than it should be. It makes it too strong, which means that it has farther to fall. So because interest rates went so low, because the financial crisis in 2008 was such a large crisis, it pushed a lot more money than would have been pushed in these emerging markets otherwise, which means they had farther to fall. And then the way that these crises tend to work is that there can be interest rate increases in core countries without it causing a set of emerging market crises, of course, right? These are really sort of threshold events. It's the interest rate increases causing stress. And if it causes enough stress, everyone panics and sells the currency, and then we have a crisis, right? So essentially what we're seeing here is that this is a bigger version of what we see essentially every time core countries start raising interest rates. So this is actually something that happens fairly frequently when these core countries, in particular the U.S., start raising interest rates, is it generally always starts putting pressure on emerging markets, right? Or emerging markets and developing economies. So this one is not fundamentally different than other times the U.S. has, you know, started raising rates, but it's just much bigger, and it's caused more of these sort of more of this pressure to turn into crises because it's been so much bigger, because interest rates were so low for so long, which caused more money than usual to flow into emerging markets, which made their currencies get, you know, very strong relative to where they should be, which means they had very far to fall, which means that they became very vulnerable to hitting this threshold where you get these sell-offs that everyone panics, sells the currency, and then it turns into a full-on crisis.
Gotcha. So then as sort of a follow-up to that, we've identified sort of this one common cause that ties the currency depreciation across the world together in a certain way, but clearly these countries also have unique circumstances, right? And while I'm maybe not as familiar with all of them, except maybe Turkey, because I spent a lot of time studying Turkey, you know, how do we go about identifying sort of what puts pressure on these countries differently? And for example, with Turkey, you know, they have an external debt to GDP of something like 55%. Maybe it's more now, and that's public and private sector. And the reason that that sort of exposes the currency for the sake of our listeners is when you borrow in foreign currency, if your domestic currency depreciates, then paying back that foreign debt or that debt denominated in foreign currency becomes more expensive because your own currency is weaker. Now, Pakistan, and I think this is a comparable metric, their external debt to GDP is something only like 30%. And yet they have been needing to seek these bridge loans from China to kind of tie them over because their foreign exchange reserves are falling in an attempt to keep the Pakistan rupee relatively strong. There's been talk about an IMF loan, which the US was at first against, but now they kind of seem okay about. And they just, it looks like they're inking a $10 billion deal with Saudi Arabia. So they're having a balance of payment situation, basically, with foreign exchange reserves down and currency weakening. So like what, but their external debt is low. So how do these countries find themselves in situations where their currency is particularly vulnerable?
So this is a really interesting direction to go in, because there's just so many things that matter here. But one of the really interesting ways that I'd kind of start by answering this question is that even though currency crises and these currency crashes overall are very similar in terms of what we observe on the surface, the currency takes a nosedive and becomes worth way less. There's very, very different sets of processes and vulnerabilities that can lead to that type of crisis. So for example, a crisis like what we saw in Southeast Asia in 1997, even though it culminated in the same currency, you know, crash event as we're seeing sort of happen now in places like Pakistan and Turkey, it was deeply fundamentally different because there's all different types of combinations of vulnerabilities, but they follow a few distinct patterns. So you have one basic pattern of currency crises that are very, very based on economic factors and economic fundamentals, oftentimes budget deficits. So if a country is running very large budget deficits with a fixed exchange rate, what tends to happen is that those large budget deficits create inflation, which makes it so that domestic goods are very expensive and foreign goods are very cheap. So now everyone buys foreign goods instead, which puts pressure on their currency to weaken. But if they have a fixed exchange rate, it can't. So they eventually just run down reserves until there's a speculative attack. And that's very fundamentally different than what we are sort of seeing with Turkey, which is a little closer to what we saw with the crises in Southeast Asia in the late 90s, which is where you have countries that have borrowed quite a bit denominated in foreign currency. And then what happens is whenever some sort of global shock hits, whether it's this rise in U.S. interest rates, whether it's some hint of domestic financial instability, anything that makes it so markets get nervous about there being the potential for the currency to weaken, then you see the speculative attacks. And that's when the currency crash happens. And the reason for that is this very interesting sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, where what happens is because of this currency mismatch, that's what we call the borrowing in foreign currency that you were discussing. Because of this currency mismatch, everyone knows, everyone who's looking at this country from the outside or people who are looking at this event from inside the country know that if the currency does start to weaken at all, everyone who's borrowed money is going to really struggle to service their debt and repay their loans, which means you're going to start seeing loans default or people default on loans, which means you're going to start seeing stress in the financial system, which means that you're going to start seeing, you know, financial crises or a financial crisis in the country potentially, which makes everyone very, very nervous. And what do people do when they get nervous? They want to get their money. They want to get out of Dodge, right? So they take their money, they pull it out of the country. Well, that act of taking their money and pulling it out of the country creates this big event where everyone's selling the currency, which actually creates the depreciation, which creates the people defaulting on these loans, which creates this very crisis event that everyone was nervous about in the first place. So what you can have here are situations that look very similar to Turkey, which looks a little more like this sort of foreign currency denominated debt, kind of financial system oriented type of event. Or you can have places that look more like that are a little closer to what we have seen in like Argentina and such, where you basically, for some reason, it's not always budget deficits. There can be plenty of other reasons for this, but for some reason, people are spending a lot more money in the country than they're producing of goods and services, which means that they are basically filling in the gap by buying more stuff from abroad than they are selling to foreign countries, which means they're running these current account deficits. And then what this does is that because in order to run this current account deficit, the countries have to sell their foreign exchange reserves. What this does is it creates a vulnerability whenever some sort of global shock happens that makes people lose confidence in the currency and think that it's going to eventually fall. What they do, knowing that this country is vulnerable because of the current account deficit, because they're running down reserves, then everyone goes and sells the currency to get rid of it before it becomes worth nothing. And then that creates, again, this crash because everyone's selling the currency and such. So these crises can happen from, and these are just two of sort of a broad set of different ways which these currency crashes can manifest. But there's all different types of underlying vulnerabilities that can culminate in these big currency crisis events. They more often than not involve some sort of global trigger, whether it's a global trigger related to risk, like the U.S. housing market crashing, or a global trigger related to interest rates, like the U.S. raising rates over the past 6 months and such. Some combination of that trigger and then some inherent domestic vulnerability, whether it's, say, more credit-oriented, or whether it's large budget deficits, or whether it's large current accounts, you know, trade deficits and such.
Now, I have a couple questions. I think you mentioned that in 2008, part of what drove the depth of the U.S. recession was that when the U.S. stock market and economy started to tank, there was a capital outflow as well, right? A lot of capital fled the United States. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those things that the U.S. tends to be, yeah, I mean, it happened to a certain degree, but a lot of what was happening in the U.S. was more shifts among different risk profiles, moving from less to more liquid.
Okay.
And then, of course, all those less liquid assets became worth a lot less, which weakened up people's balance sheets and stuff. In core countries, it tends to operate very differently because in core countries, when it gets riskier, people tend to come to the country because Right. Even if that's the genesis of the weakness, it's still safer than Pakistan and such.
Right. So there's nowhere safer for an investor to move their money to when the United States collapses.
Right. Yeah. If the U.S. goes, everything goes. So,
right. Okay.
Yeah. So even when the U.S. is sort of the cause of that vulnerability, you can often see people flocking to the safety of U.S., you know, almost paradoxically, until you think about it a little more, almost yes. flocking to the safety of U.S. assets there.
Yes. Well, and in particular, it's like the government assets and the harder assets.
Yeah, the treasuries.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than the stock market, for example. So what's happening when the U.S. goes through recession is a movement of capital from, let's say, real estate in 2008 and the stock market to things like treasuries, bonds, in particular, because that allows the United States to actually drive the interest rate down because demand has spiked so much for these things, who can drive the interest rate down to, you know, and take on all these bonds or you know, issue all these bonds to, and then the United States can then use the money that's come in through these bonds to drive a stimulus program, but also because the interest rate is dropped, it's able to, and that stimulus program is, let's see, fiscal policy. And then
yes.
It's also able to drive, by driving down the interest rate, it's able to use monetary policy to add credit to the system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yes.
Okay, so the U.S. has all these tools that these other countries don't, or at least they have them in much bigger, more powerful ways to be able to deal with these crises, whereas I expect Turkey is sitting there going, crap.
Yeah. So these countries, so these emerging markets and developing economies are often caught in much more of a tough situation when these types of events occur. Because in the U.S., something like 2008 hits, it's very easy to, you know, essentially take those steps as you just outlined. Monetary policy, lower interest rates, you know, people are flocking to safe assets. So there isn't too much pressure on the dollar. There isn't, you know, these big capital outflows and things like that. However, in emerging markets, places like Pakistan and Turkey, what you tend to see, or what you actually see here, is that these countries, as people lose faith in them and people try to pull their money out, they're constrained from engaging in those two things. They're not able to engage in the monetary stimulus, basically print off a bunch of money. For our purposes here, print off a bunch of money and then push it out into the financial system to lower interest rates. They can't do that, because what that would do now is lower interest rates at the same time that risk is rising. So your nominal return of investing in the country has fallen, and your risk-adjusted return of investing in the country is also bringing that even farther down. So if these countries are under stress, these emerging markets, if they're under stress and they try to engage in monetary stimulus, all they do is just speed up the capital outflows, which makes their exchange rate fall faster, which makes their country look even worse, which makes it look riskier, which speeds up the outflows and just puts them in an even tougher, you know, situation. Also, on the fiscal policy side for these countries, what's happening is that as these countries are having their exchange rate weaken and such, typically because they're borrowing in foreign currency, they're borrowing in dollars more often than not. Now, all the money the government owes is larger in terms of their domestic currency. So in terms of how much they have to levy in taxes to pay it, that number just went up. So their fiscal position looks worse. And because the country's riskier, the interest they're paying just went up, because they have to, you know, because now investors want a higher return for investing in the riskier country. So now at the same time that they want to engage in the fiscal stimulus, their debt just went up and their interest payments just went up. And to even just pile it on, because I know it's bad enough already, but let's just pile it on. If they engage in the fiscal stimulus, what that will do is increase domestic demand, and it's not going to have much of an effect on domestic production. So you increase domestic demand, how much you're spending relative to how much you're producing. What that's going to do is weaken your current account even farther. So these countries are already having their currency crash, and that's typically because their current account was weak beforehand. Now, if they engage in fiscal stimulus, they're going to expedite these outflows through the current account and through the trade balance. So they're already having capital fleeing the country through the capital account or the financial account. And if they try to engage in a fiscal stimulus to prevent a recession and such, now they're going to also speed up outflows through the current account. And those two things are fundamentally incompatible, because your current account balance essentially is just the negative of your capital account balance or your financial account balance. So the only way that's reconciled is by increasing the rate of depreciation, which puts even farther pressure on their currency to weaken. So for these countries like Pakistan, Turkey, Argentina, that are emerging markets that aren't in that great position that the U.S. is in, where we can essentially be the cause of a crisis and still have people want to bring money into our country, they just get caught between a rock, a hard place, another hard place, and another rock.
Wow, man, that's a raw effing deal.
Yeah. So it's one of those things that's why these countries often, when they have these sorts of currency crises, and unless they're able to get some pretty solid and effective IMF intervention or something similar to that, they end up having these just devastating crises.
So for the United States, we have, you know, I'm not even going to ask you, have we kept interest rates historically low for an historically long period of time? Yes, we have.
Yeah, that's so someone's going to fight you on that one.
Yeah, exactly. So like not really doing that. That's just a fact. But so what the F is going on with that? Because even the Keynesians revealing my bias here. But, you know, typically my understanding is the idea is when times are good, you're booming. You know, we've had, what, 15 record breaking stock market moments. We've got very low unemployment. Like you should have a higher interest rate and, you know, so that you can dip the interest rate later when things go poorly, when the business cycle changes. But, you know, that's the common wisdom. I think very briefly, maybe for some of our listeners, why would you ever increase the interest rate? Like, you know, isn't capital availability good? And then also, why the F has it taken so long? And like, what are the potential consequences of that?
So as to the first answer, the reason that you would ever raise the interest rate, the sort of textbook Econ 101 answer is that if the economy starts what we call overheating, unemployment gets too low and such, it creates inflationary pressure. You know, so rising prices, which causes a lot of long-term costs to the economy for, you know, through a variety of mechanisms. Having high inflation just ends up being very costly in the long run. So what tends to happen is once unemployment starts getting low and inflation starts rising, you start raising interest rates to kind of rein in things and prevent that inflation. In a modern economy, in a more modern treatment of, or a more modern sort of understanding of how the economic system works, the bigger issue is financial stability. When you have these very, very low interest rates, it tends to make people borrow money for investments that are not necessarily viable in the long run. You kind of get this irrational exuberance where everyone can borrow money easily, which bids up asset prices, which makes everyone even more confident, which bids up asset prices, which makes everyone even more confident, which bids up asset prices again, and just feeds into itself.
And then at some point you get crazy enough, you start investing in tech startups, and then you're in real trouble.
Yeah, that's a, yeah, that wouldn't have been my first one. I was, but yeah, yeah,
okay.
It just spirals out of control, or it can very easily spiral out of control if you let things go unchecked.
Right. Cause what's happening is with a interest rate, what you're actually doing is fixing the price and printing as much money as people demand at that price, which means and that's how fiat currency works. You've got essentially a limitless supply at a certain price of money. And so if the interest rate is really low and it's driving, that's starting to drive the stock market up, you go like, oh man, drive a market up, any market, you start going like, oh, well, I can borrow at 2% and I can get a 10% return. So then everyone starts doing that because any one person doing it is perfectly rational to do that, because why wouldn't you? But then once everyone does it, you're just, the market is going up just because people are throwing money at it, not because the fundamentals are there. And then you get a bubble that's going to pop.
Yeah, it becomes unstable. And then the bigger that bubble is, the bigger the bust is later.
Yeah. So why the F has it taken us so long to raise our interest rates?
That's a great question. And if you're going to pose that question, it should be aimed at the people who are at the Fed. So my perspective on this, or my understanding of this, is that the Fed is primarily targeting the unemployment inflation kind of nexus. And while they're of course paying a lot of attention to financial stability, a lot of what it looks like the Fed has been doing in the past 8 years in terms of trying to maintain financial stability has been by creating and looking at different sorts of tools than monetary policy. Things like looking at what's called contingent convertible bonds, where if a bank sells this bond, and if the bank comes under a certain amount of stress, it gets wiped off their books and turned into equity. Or looking at these different sorts of factors related to capital adequacy. So the Fed, it looks like, and again, at this point, I'm just giving my opinion of what the Fed has been doing. It looks like a lot of what the Fed has been doing is continuing to use monetary policy to primarily handle the unemployment inflation nexus, and is looking at financial stability through different sorts of tools. And personally, I think that's insufficient, but that's veering off into purely my opinion.
So we've kind of now traced a link between some of the emerging market currency issues and how that has to do with the US, how it has to do with external borrowing, and the implications of what will probably be a continuation of U.S. monetary policy to increase rates. I want to turn now to a slightly less developing country, I guess is one way to put it. China, it's still a developing country, still kind of an emerging market in ways, but not in other ways. And clearly the thing that's going to be on a lot of people's minds, and we've done an episode on this, but now it's time to get a new perspective on it, is the trade war. Wow. And it's easy to think that we are at the end of a cycle right now in the U.S.
Oh, I certainly think so.
Yeah. I mean, it's been 9 years, and most growth periods last between like 8 and 10 years, right? If you go back 70 years. So we're there just statistically. And as the Federal Reserve raises rates, and even as more money flows into the U.S., the question is, how is the trade war going to affect what might have just been a run-of-the-mill recession? I'm not saying it will be, but how does the being at the end of the business cycle play into what's going on right now with U.S. trade policy?
That's a great question. Now, so trade is this whole own animal, and it definitely plays into all these factors. Like, I mean, so for example, when we were talking about current accounts earlier, for most countries, the current account is mostly just the trade balance, right? And so this is all, everything we've talked about is heavily related to trade. But the thing is, when you start to see these sorts of, you know, tariff increases, and you start to see things like this, that can have an effect on the business cycle, but it often doesn't do as much with financial cycle. And when we think about things that creates, like the banking crisis we saw in 2008, the currency crisis that we're seeing right now in emerging markets, that's very much related to these sorts of movements in credit, these sort of long-running credit cycles, these long-running assets, these cycles in asset values that are very sort of financial in nature. Whereas tariffs and such, they very rarely spark crises. It's more like they're recessionary, but they're much less likely to sort of kick off a crisis. So if you're looking at what's happening with the trade war, the economy is weaker than it would have been without it. I have zero doubt on that. But the probability that it's a trigger for another crisis, I think, is going to be relatively low. Now, if that compounds with things like the tightening of monetary policy, then yeah, I mean, I think it could play in, right? Because and this is just, you know, one example off the top of my head, the increase in tariffs is going to cause prices in the U.S. to go up. I mean, that's like the point of a tariff, is to make things cost more. If that makes prices go up, that causes inflation to rise, which maybe makes the Fed hike quicker, which magnifies the pressure on emerging markets, as well as increasing those increasing interest rates, or that quicker pace of increasing interest rates, putting more pressure on U.S. banks and such. So I could see any effect that tariffs may have on the timing of, you know, sort of the next downturn. If they're going to have an effect, which I wouldn't say with confidence, I think it would be through speeding up the pace of U.S. interest rate increases, much more so than kind of sparking it themselves. I mean, I think it's very possible they could magnify a recession, or they could make growth lower than it would have been otherwise. I'm almost positive in that. But I think it's very, very unlikely that there'll be a trigger.
I think the other thing that we have to ask is that early this year, there was a really big tax cut, but also just, you know, tax structure change that was passed. And I think we can speculate all day about whether it was a good idea per se, or, you know, to what extent it's going to have an impact on the economy as a whole. But I think the, you know, it comes at a time when the United States has had a slow but very long upward business cycle. It comes at a time when, you know, I think a number of economists were starting to predict that a downward cycle was on its way. Then all of a sudden this tax cut shows up and, you know, the market seemed to react positively. The like stock market seemed to react positively to that, which a lot of people seem to think is a proxy for economic health, which obviously I have my own questions about that. But is the timing of this tax cut going to be significant in the United States and global business cycle? And is there any kind of obvious consensus on what kind of impact it could have short term versus long term?
Oh, absolutely. So the best way to think about fiscal policy over the business cycle, well, first off, how it should work, and then I'm going to go into how it occurs. And then you're going to see when I talk about how it occurs that what's happening now is just a perfect example. of how things are done wrong. So whether or not you engage in a sort of Keynesian counter-cyclical stimulus, that basic idea that when the economy is bad, the government should spend more, and when the economy is good, the government should spend less. Right now, that's the basic Keynesian counter-cyclical spending idea. And it's founded upon the idea that, that has a lot of empirical support, that government spending in a bust or a bad time is very, very, has a very large effect in stimulating the economy. Because you're in a recession, there's resources that aren't being mobilized and such. So the government spending $1 that wasn't going to get spent goes very far. In a boom, whenever the government borrows a dollar to spend, it's borrowing a dollar that would have been spent otherwise because you're in a boom. Everyone's spending money. Unemployment's low. So the stimulative effect of spending at the peak of the business cycle is very, very small. So using that logic, the fact that it's very, very cost effective to borrow and spend at the downturn of the business cycle, and it's very, very cost ineffective to borrow and spend at the peak of the business cycle, what you would want to do here is spend more money when it's going to be effective, which is when you're in a recession, and then spend less when it's going to be ineffective, which is in the boom, right? And that's something, and that's not something that's too controversial. It's measurable that what we call the fiscal multiplier shifts quite a bit across the business cycle, that it's relatively high in the bust and relatively low in the boom. But the thing is, even if we toss all that to the side and we ignore this idea of countercyclical spending, you're still going to have the budget deficit shift across the business cycle. Because where do taxes come from, right? You're taxing income. You're taxing, for the most part, you're taxing income, whether it's corporate or personal. So what happens here is when you have a recession and the economy slows down, there's less income to tax. So even if you keep spending exactly the same, when you get into a recession, the deficit is always going to increase because tax revenues fall. And then when you get into a boom, you're always going to take in more in tax revenues because now there's more income to tax. So even if you keep tax rates exactly the same, you're going to see big deficits in a recession and small deficits in a boom. And that's one of those things that's going to happen regardless of whether you engage in the Keynesian, countercyclical spending. If you do, that pattern is going to be even more pronounced because now you're not just seeing revenues fall in the boom, you're also seeing spending rise. You're not just seeing revenues fall in the bust, you're seeing spending go up, and you're not just seeing revenues rise in the boom, you're seeing spending go down. Right, so it's just magnified if you engage in the kind of cyclical spending. So that's the basic idea of how fiscal policy should and kind of does work across the business cycle in certain cases. However, what we tend to see more often is that when the bust hits, everyone engages in this big stimulus spending to try to get their economy going again because they know that the fiscal multiplier is high. So a dollar spent now is going to go relatively far. However, once you get farther into the boom, and this is what we're seeing at this exact moment right now, tax revenues are up, the economy looks great, no one's thinking about the next bust. So what they're saying is, hey, the economy looks great, we have a lot of tax revenues, let's spend more, let's cut taxes. And then what that does is it increases deficits at the peak of the business cycle too. And then now, instead of cutting deficits when the economy is good, the deficit stays the same or gets even larger. So when the next downturn comes, you already have a massive deficit and there's no room left to spend even more to try to get yourself out of the recession. So what you tend to see, and what we're seeing today with this current tax cut and the fact that the US deficit has gone from, I don't know, maybe half a trillion to almost a trillion in 2 years, we're seeing right now at the peak of the business cycle, we're raising deficits and essentially goosing the economy with stimulus spending at the exact wrong time. And that, in addition to being very ineffective, because each dollar is not going very far in terms of stimulus spending at the peak of the business cycle, it's also making it so that when the next downturn comes, we're already going to have trillion-dollar deficits, and tax revenues are going to go down, and there's going to be pressure for stimulus spending to get us out of the recession. So something like $2 trillion, $2.5 trillion deficits, if we have a recession in the next year or two, is not out of the question.
But if we draw a linear line from where we are now, it'll pay for itself. It'll be great.
Well, the U.S. debt to GDP is 104% right now. So,
oh boy,
yeah. So it hasn't worked out great in the past 60 years.
It's almost as if political considerations are trumping long-term economic ones.
Fiscal. Oh, first time for everything, right?
Yeah, I know. Who'd have ever thunk it?
Yeah.
Given that that happens and that that is the case and that politicians have a tendency to do things that appease their constituency, even if it isn't in the best long-term interest of their country's economy, how do we get out of this? I mean, if we're just going to see I think the CBO's estimate was like an additional $1.45 trillion added to the budget over the course of the next 10 years as a result of this tax plan. And we're probably facing another recession at some point in the not too distant future. And at that point, politicians will probably be encouraged to undertake deficit spending in order to engage in this countercyclical fiscal stimulus that you're talking about. How do we ever get out of this? Is this a new normal? Or is it just like Warren Buffett says, we're just going to have to inflate our way out of it at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I guess first things first, I wouldn't even go so far as say this is new normal. I would just say this is pretty much how it tends to work, right? Because politicians, well, in democracies for sure, and there are other softer mechanisms that create this same sort of effect in non-democracies, but politicians' primary concern is the next election, right? So they're concerned 2 to 4 years in advance in most countries. And now when you look at this sort of fiscal policy, you know, scenario, you have this sort of paradox that deficits are very, very good for the economy in the short run. But debt is bad for the economy in the long run, as long if it, you know, exceeds certain thresholds and such. So what happens here is that if you're trying to win an election in 2 years, or let's say, when was the tax cut passed, or when did it take effect? February? 8 months. Then the best thing to do is cut taxes, increase spending, let the deficit rise, stimulate the economy through that mechanism. And then what you're doing is, you know, kind of goosing the economy, unemployment's going to fall, things are going to look good. But what you're doing is just stacking up this debt that in the long run is going to generate costs. And so if you're in the political sphere and you're reacting to political incentives, it is optimal for you and, you know, the sort of individualistic perspective to just goose the economy with deficits to win the next election. However, there's always a next election. So what you get oftentimes is this continuous goosing of the economy, stimulating the economy with deficits. And then that leads to this just constant accumulation of debt. That's a large reason for why most of the world that doesn't have massive oil resources has governments that have fairly large debt, because everyone is engaging in what we call these sort of political business cycles, where as soon as the next election is coming up, they try to goose the economy through either deficit spending or whether it's or perhaps strengthening the exchange rate to make foreign goods cheaper, or if you don't have an independent central bank, lowering the interest rate to create some small inflation that stimulates the economy, which is actually why we have independent central banks, because when you don't, everyone just does that. And yeah, so it just creates a scenario where you have things that are very good for the economy in the short run can often be very bad for the economy in the long run. And political actors following their short run political incentives that are centered around the next election tend to go for the policy that makes things look good in the short run, but creates problems in the long run. And that's what we're seeing right now in the US with the increases in the deficit spending at the peak of the business cycle.
I mean, it's a classic problem kind of situation where, you know, there's an accountability gap. And I think you know, I've heard people make this argument about like CEOs of publicly traded companies as well, where, you know, you need to do the thing that's going to get the next quarter's earnings in.
Yeah.
It may not be best for the business long-term. It's actually often one of the core arguments I hear in the tech startup world about, well, why can't this company do the thing that you're doing and just envelop you?
It's like, well, because
they have a fundamental problem of being focused on quarterly earnings. And, you know, the guy, like, you don't get points for investing in something that's going to manifest 5 years from now because you're gone, right? So it doesn't affect your bonus. And so sort of the same thing for, you know, a congressperson or a president, where, you know, when something goes terribly, terribly wrong, in the future, it's not your problem. And when it goes wrong for you because someone did something in the past, it is your problem. And you can try to blame the guy before you, and the people in your party will go, yeah, it was the guy before you. And the people not in your party will go, no, it's probably your fault. But guess what? You couldn't have done anything about it anyway. You just kind of like got handed this pile of poo, and now you've got to do your best with it. So it's a really interesting incentives problem for democracies as a whole, where there is the folks who have a lot of tools and power to, you know, manage a lot of the economy at from a macro level. They don't have the incentives to do the thing that's best long term. I think I remember once saying that, you know, part of my own personal theory on why the interest rate wasn't going up for a long time is that it's really hard to look at the public and say, I'm going to be the one that starts to put some water on this fire, right? I'm going to be the one to start to cool the party down, flash the lights at the bar, tell everyone it's time to go home and sleep it off because there's work in the morning, right? Who wants to be the one to spoil the party? And so, you know, I'm assuming this is part of why you think it's, you know, this is the norm. I hate to ask you this question because you may go, I don't know, but, you know, is there any way that, you know, academic economists who, you know, I'm sure some of whom see this incentive gap, is there any like proposed structure for a government to be able to realign these incentives?
Yeah. So with the monetary policy, it was pretty much figured out with this by utilizing independent central banks or trading central banks or independent central banks, because the whole reason the Fed is independent, the whole reason that the president can't just grab the head of the Fed and say, hey, do this with the monetary policy, is specifically for this exact reason we're talking about with the compatibility of incentives. Because in places where the president gets to pick monetary policy, what's it in their best interest to do? Keep interest rates low, keep unemployment low, which leads to high inflation, which leads to higher growth than what we would have had otherwise in the short term, but lower growth than we would have had otherwise in the long term, right? It comes back to this big divergence between what's beneficial for the economy or what looks beneficial for the economy in the short run versus what's actually beneficial in the long term.
All right, hoo boy, everyone, please forgive the technical difficulty on my side. We know how to fix it. It's going to take about a week and a half, and then we'll be back in action with Jake Meyer, who we're so excited to finish this conversation with just as it was getting interesting. So you get a bit of a cliffhanger this time, but we promise we'll wrap things up next time Jake is around once I'm in a location with slightly better internet. So until next time, dear listeners, don't let the pundits do the thinking for you. Pause and reconsider. Stay tuned for part two.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.